One, two, three, Natalie!
Hi, and welcome to the Person Natalie podcast. I'm your host, Natalie. Today's special guest is Ben Klein. Ben is one of my best friends, and I'm so excited to have him on the show. He's been a very dedicated listener. Ben is an attorney in DC, and we originally met while we were clerking in Hawaii together. So Ben, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Natalie. Happy to be here.
Yeah. Okay, so I think we should start talking about a little bit about Hawaii, where we met, and kind of our experiences there. That was, I think, the best year of my life.
Yeah. I think that cumulative year was one of the best of my life because I had just come from Cambodia, which was just a great chapter where I was living and working for about 6 months. Mm. And I couldn't think of a perfect next place to go to other than Hawaii.
Yeah. What do you miss about Hawaii the most?
I miss our weekend adventures the most. Hawaii was one of the few places I've ever lived where you could spend the morning at some of the most beautiful beaches in the world, crystal clear waters of Kailua. In the afternoons, you can be hiking into the clouds, or you could do the reverse, which is normally how we spend our Saturdays.
Yeah. Okay, so speaking about travels, you are actually one of the best solo travelers that I've ever met. And you just really like throw yourselves into like all these crazy situations and countries and meet interesting people along the way. So tell us a little bit about those trips.
For the past couple of years, I've taken at least one trip, one big international trip. And oftentimes comes in the fall when I have time. One year I went to Nepal and I did a hike to Everest. Another year, a couple years ago now, I went to Myanmar and I backpacked through Myanmar. And more recently, I did this trip to India, Sri Lanka. I spent a day in the Maldives and then I spent a day in Dubai. It was a long layover in Dubai. And the highlights of that trip were two. The first was my time in Mumbai. And that's the only city I went to when I was in India. When I was photographing around the city and in one place in particular, a slum that's called the Dharavi slum. And my second highlight is probably photographing in a market called Peta Market, which is it's a commercial market in Colombo, Sri Lanka. And it's not a place that a lot of people go to because it's a market where you can't just buy like a couple bananas. You're usually buying like 100 bananas at a time. Like that's a place where stores go to buy and purchase goods. And there weren't many tourists there. And I was kind of a novelty going around taking pictures. And I just had a blast photographing people.
Ben, you also, when you travel, you have like kind of a journal and you collect some of the things that you, like business cards and travel stubs.
So I collect some stuff and I hope it's not a reflection of my hoarding tendencies, but I have a really cool passport book. It's one of my most prized possessions. I love my passport. It's 6 years in the making right now, expires in 2019, and it's already had an extra set of pages put in it and has all these fascinating things. And it's not just ticket stubs. It's the most important possessions that I have in that are the business cards of some pretty interesting people I've met along the way while traveling. Like, for instance, I have the business card of this guy named Zaza, who is based in Mandalay in Burma and Myanmar. And Zaza he's kind of a tour guide, but he's more than that. He's just a fascinating guy. He also does just transport. I spent 2.5 days on the back of his motorcycle traveling around Mandalay in the outskirts, visiting monasteries, going to local carnivals, eating at traditional restaurants, doing all sorts of stuff that you don't normally get to do. And this guy was like such a sweet guy, very interesting guy. And yeah, so, you know, people like that. And then there's a taxi driver named Dario, who I met when I was in Medellin, which is in Colombia. And Dario used to be a soccer player on Pablo Escobar's team. And, you know, just a fortuitous encounter. But he ended up taking me on a day-long tour of Medellin where we traveled around and we went to the different sites where Pablo Escobar did X or Y, or, you know, the famous shootout where he was ultimately killed, and had absolutely fascinating stories. So what I have and what I try to limit to in my passport book or my travel book is interesting business cards and rare mementos from my travels.
One other theme that I've noticed and we've talked about is that you like to befriend public transportation people throughout the world.
I love it.
Yeah. What do you love about it?
Public transportation people. It's kind of a weird category, right? Here's how I describe it. People who get you around. And depending on what part of the world you're in, that can be so many different forms of transportation. When I was living in Cambodia and when I was traveling in Myanmar, oftentimes I was traveling on the back of a motorcycle or a moped. But, you know, like I said, when I was in Colombia, I was traveling in a taxi cab. Or also when I was living in Cambodia, I traveled around a lot in a tuk-tuk. What I like about this mode of travel is that you're connecting with local people in a really personal way. And a lot of these public transportation drivers have a lot of really useful information and can provide you with an unfiltered perspective that you can't always get elsewhere. They can tell you where to go and where not to go. They can tell you where you can get a cheap, delicious local lunch. They can tell you about the communities that they live in and share stories with you about how the country has changed over time. They can serve as translators as much as they can serve as shepherds or people that can get you from point A to point B. They can help you get the lay of the land much more quickly than you could if you're just trying to figure out things on your own or, you know, reading a blog just to kind of figure out how the city's set up. So I really try to look for good transportation drivers when I get to.
Yeah. How do you identify these people?
My Cambodian tuk-tuk driver, who's a pretty exceptional person in my life. His name is Polo, and I met him on my first full day when I was living in Phnom Penh, Cambodia. And the way I met Polo is I was staying at a hotel on the street called Golden Street. That's the nickname of this street. Anyway, I exit this place. I'm in a very strange land. I've only been in Asia now for like 3 or 4 days. It's 5 days after I've taken the bar. And I'm still delirious and I'm still trying to figure out where the hell I am. And so I go out on the street and I'm a pretty intrepid eater. When I travel, I really like to try local foods. And I see this woman who is carrying on her head a basket and it has some interesting food in it. And it was like rice rolled up in some sort of paper or leaf. And I walk up to this woman very naively and I start trying to ask her whether or not it's vegetarian. Meanwhile, all these tuk-tuk drivers, there are about 10 tuk-tuk drivers, are all heckling me for their business. And I'm like trying to communicate with a woman who clearly does not speak English. I'm trying to shoo off these tuk-tuk drivers. And it's just like a lot of noise and just a confusing situation. And all of a sudden, I hear this one pipe up in Khmer, the local language in Cambodia, and he's communicating with this woman. And he's standing kind of in the back of the herd of these tuk-tuk drivers who have circled around me. And it's clear that he understood what I was trying to convey to this woman, that I didn't eat meat. And he then, after speaking to her and, you know, two or three sentence exchange, turns to me and he tells me in English, "Oh, you can eat that. There's no meat." And it was with a soft voice, but it carried over, you know, this crowd of other tuk-tuk drivers who were still kind of heckling me. And I knew instantaneously that there was something special about this guy because he was able, first of all, he wasn't just trying to get my business. He was actually trying to help. And two, he had a sensitivity to my questions that most people wouldn't have had. Especially most people that didn't speak English as a first language. So I ended up getting this food. But then I went over to this guy, Polo, and I introduced myself. And I said, "I want you to take me around the city. And I'll pay you for the entire day. What's your price?" And he said, "Oh, whatever you want to pay me." And I said, "Well, it's my first day here. I really don't know how much to pay you, but whatever you think is a fair price." And he goes, "Oh, no, whatever you want to pay." And I mean, you know, at that point I felt like, oh, this is, not only is this a nice person, but he's seems like a pretty honest person too. So we negotiated a price and I spent the entire day with him. We probably spent 5 or 6 hours together and we went to some of the most important places in Phnom Penh in the surrounding area. I told him that I wanted to go to some of the cultural heritage sites. So we went to, I think we started off at the Royal Palace and then we went to some of the more sobering sites. We went to a prison and torture center called Tol Sleng. It's a pretty tough place to visit. It's in the center of the city. And I was particularly interested in sites like that because my purpose in Cambodia was to assist the prosecutors for a UN tribunal called the Extraordinary Chambers in the Courts of Cambodia, a UN tribunal that was set up to try Khmer Rouge crimes. So we went there and I walked through that prison and torture center there with Polo. And then after that experience, we went out to the killing fields. For the uninitiated, the killing fields are essentially the equivalent of a concentration camp meets death camp. And I actually had a really sobering and eye-opening experience there. Because I learned a very valuable lesson that day. Aside from how great Polo was, I learned perhaps an even greater lesson about the sensitivity to issues in Cambodia, which was this. I asked Polo to come into the killing fields with me, and he was reluctant to do it. And when I asked him, he pointed to a sign, which was the equivalent of like a no smoking sign with a tuk-tuk in it. And I looked at it and I said, Polo, you're not coming in as my tuk-tuk driver, you're going to come in as my friend. And he said, oh, no, you're not supposed to bring tuk-tuk drivers in. And the purpose was they didn't want any unofficial guides. And I said, Polo, you'll come in as my friend. So he came in and we started walking around. And one of the first things that you get to when you walk into the killing fields is this, it's like a tower. And you walk up and as you get closer, what you see are these shelves with a glass cover. And on these shelves are skulls. And they're human skulls. And there are many of them. And they were recovered from the grounds that we were walking on. And I'm walking around with Polo. And within minutes, he starts talking to me about his experience living in Cambodia in the 1970s as a child. And it very quickly became apparent to me that he had lived through the worst years in Cambodia from 76 to 79. And he had been in the equivalent of concentration camps. And he had lost family members during that period. And it was a very hard thing for him to talk about. And I tried my best not to be probing about it because I realized that he was very sensitive to that experience. But it taught me a lot about what happened, about, you know, kind of the personal effects that had on people and people's lives. And most important of all, it taught me that anybody over the age of 40 in that country that I would come into contact with had probably lived through those years. And I had to be very careful and sensitive to those issues because most of those people lost family. Most of those people, a lot of those people had suffered from physical and mental persecution. And, you know, ultimately it made me more aware of those experiences. And it also made my work at the tribunal, I think, a little bit more personally impactful and meaningful. Because I knew what I was doing, which was to help try some of those most responsible for the crimes, trying to bring justice for people like Polo, who had lived through some pretty horrible experiences.
Do you remember saying goodbye to Polo when you left Cambodia?
I do remember saying goodbye to Polo. Polo was a tuk-tuk driver, like I said. And after my experience that first day, he became my go-to tuk-tuk driver. So anytime I needed somebody, I would call Polo, in part because he was somebody that was incredibly reliable and I could trust, and also because I wanted to give my money to him. He had a family. He was a really nice guy. He was just somebody that I wanted to kind of invest in as a person. And, you know, he became a friend. So when I was leaving Cambodia, I decided I would take Polo to the airport, which is about a 45-minute commute if you're in a tuk-tuk. And it was a very bittersweet time to leave because it was part of this best year of my life. It was just a great time out there. But Polo picked me up. We threw all my stuff into this little carriage. And just to give people a little bit of color here, the tuk-tuks in Cambodia are a little bit different from other parts of the world. So if you go to Thailand, it's kind of a self-contained car made out of mostly out of metal. And in Cambodia, it's almost like a carriage affixed to a motorcycle. It's an interesting vehicle, but that's the way they do it there. So we cram all my luggage in there. We go on this commute and we get to the airport and, you know, Polo gets out and he helps me with my luggage. And he just starts crying and he gets so upset. He's just sad that I'm leaving and I'm sad that I'm leaving. And I go to give him a hug and I can just feel the tears streaming down his face because the hug was, you know, it was kind of like almost like a cheek to cheek hug. And it just devastated me. It was like all of the emotion I had suddenly released itself. And I had never been in a situation, at least at an airport, where I was like uncontrollably crying. And I remember I gave Paul a hug. I paid him. I walked away and I had to like take time before I went to the ticket counter to collect myself because it was just such, there was just such a flood of emotion that came out. It was like the straw that broke the camel's back. And I think for Polo, part of that was he'd made a good friend and he felt like somebody, he had met somebody that was investing in him and he was worried that it was all gone. Because people like me that, you know, cycle through jobs in Asia, they come and go. And it's very cyclical, every 6 months to a year. And most people, they spend their time there and they don't come back. And very few are actually connecting with the locals like I did with Polo. So that's why it was such an emotional moment for him and then ultimately for me.
Yeah. Do you know, I remember the first time you told us this story, it was in Kauai. We were like all, a bunch of our friends, we rented a house. And I distinctly remember we were all sitting outside and you told this story. And I was like, oh my gosh. And I was like, I'm going to be friends with this kid. Because when people can feel like you just described, I love that. Mm-hmm. Like that the ability for humans to like feel that deeply is just such a beautiful thing.
Yeah, I think it's really profound. There haven't been many moments in my life where I've had such intense, unexpected emotion. And with somebody who I didn't expect to have it.
Can you think about moments in your life when you felt the most alive?
A tradition that I have with my brother is to attend every World Cup together for the rest of our lives. And we're two World Cups in. I have one on him. I went to Germany back in 2006. And my brother and I went to South Africa back in 2010. And then most recently, Brazil. And there were definitely moments during that tournament, during the games where, and they're not even US World Cup games, but random World Cup games where you feel alive. The energy in the air is like, it's pulsating through you. Mm-hmm. And there's no other sporting event that I've ever been to where you feel that type of enthusiasm.
Mm. You know what I liked about the South Africa one? You went during while studying for the bar, right?
Especially when it comes to travel, there's little that stands in the way between me and trying to see the world. And the pact that I made with my brother is something that I really want to carry on for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
And this, I wasn't going to let, you know, the worst test I've ever taken, or maybe the worst test I've ever studied for,
yeah,
get in the way of this great experience.
Well, this store is also only good because you pass the bar. Like, it would be really sad if you failed the bar and, like, did this trip.
Well, you know, at least I would have had something to blame.
Could
have just blamed it on that.
That's true. Okay, so you mentioned that you are an extrovert, but sometimes you're an introvert. Can you, like, expand a little bit upon that?
There are times where I like to be alone and I like to have my own space. But when I think of introversion and extroversion, kind of the bottom line is, do you get your energy from yourself or from other people? And the truth is, despite the fact that sometimes I really like to be on my own and be independent, I get my energy from other people. And I gravitate to people that exude energy. I think ultimately I get more satisfaction out of times, good time spent with people I like.
Yeah.
Than I do with the time I spend on my own.
Yeah. That's interesting because I kind of think of you a little bit as a loner and independent.
I think...
Which I really like about you, by the way.
I like to fashion myself as independent. And I think I try hard in many ways to just kind of live life as I think it should be lived. But ultimately, I really value human interaction and attention. And I like surrounding myself with people and socializing.
Yeah. And you also don't shy away from confrontation, right?
Never.
Never?
I'm just kidding. No, I don't shy away from confrontation, but I don't look for it.
Okay. So when you're saying you like to surround yourself with people, what kind of people do you like to surround yourself with? What are some of the common threads, personality traits?
I look for people that inspire me, and I look for people that make me a better person and that I can learn from. Those are the people who I assign the most value to in my life and the people that I work hardest to maintain and nurture and develop those relationships.
Yeah. You have those people that you gravitate to. You're very, very good at just talking to anyone.
I can be chatty.
No, I think you can talk to pretty much anyone, BK.
You know, one of my life philosophies is that I want to treat everybody well. And so it doesn't matter if you're my, you know, the head of my law firm or the janitorial staff. I want to acknowledge them. I think people have something to offer. They have stories to tell. They have lessons to provide. They have advice and wisdom and life experience. And I think ultimately by engaging these people, you just have a better day-to-day experience.
I mean, you engage with a lot of people, Ben. Wherever we go, you engage with someone, no doubt. And I also appreciate that it's not like forever and ever. Do you know those people who like engage with people and it's like, oh my God, we have to go, stop.
Well, actually, so the last girl I was dating had this problem with me and she called me out on it. I didn't realize that I was good with talking to strangers, first of all, until Natalie said something to me. And then I started to become a little bit more cognizant of when I would do it. And then got to the point where the last girl I was dating actually like would kind of tug on my arm sometimes or she would like say something to me, but it started to make me a little bit more self-aware of how chatty I could be with random people.
Yeah. I think, you're chatty, but you're not too intrusive. I think there's like a fine line between overstepping your bounds. And I don't think you like cross that typically.
No, but I kind of wish I did sometimes.
Really?
A little bit more. Yeah. Like, and I think it's bottom line there is it has to be being more unfiltered.
Oh.
Because, I mean, sometimes I speak what I think for the most part, but there are certain people that everybody has in their lives who will just say whatever they think. And, you know, sometimes people do it to a fault.
Yeah.
But sometimes people do it perfectly where they say the things that other people are thinking and they turn what could be an awkward exchange into like kind of a funny moment. And more often than not, I try not to cross that line.
Why?
Because I fear it being misinterpreted. And I mean, especially with strangers, you don't know how they're going to interact. Yeah. I mean, with close friends, I feel like I'm more candid, but not with strangers, even though it could make for good comedy if I was.
Oh, I don't know about that. Ben is very many great things, but comedian, I don't know.
Speaking of comedy, I have a joke for you.
Oh, what's the joke?
And by the way, Natalie thinks I'm just terrible at jokes.
No, so. Not just I think. This is like a well-known fact. Remember, everything on this podcast is fact. Our group of friends have said, and Ben, he's very funny when he's not trying to be, but then sometimes he'll like execute a joke. And then we're like, wait, where's the punchline? And he's like, well, I just said it. And we're all just like looking at each other like, what? And his delivery is very...
Bad.
Yeah, bad.
Yeah. Bad. I'm a bad joke teller. I'm a bad rehearsed joke teller, but I'm going to go ahead and interview.
Well, you know why? It's because you like come in so determined and you're like, yeah. I'm going to tell this joke. And it's like building up in your head. And then, you know, sometimes it just needs to like flow and then it's not smooth. And we're just, and it ends up being really, really funny, but not because of the joke, but it's because like how hard Ben is trying to be funny.
All right.
So now with that build up.
I'm not going to do the jokes.
No, you have to do the jokes now.
No, I'll slide them in, maybe.
Oh my gosh. No one's going to get it though, because you're not a good joke delivery person.
All right, I'll tell you one of the jokes right now. Are you ready?
Yeah, I'm ready.
How do you make water holy?
How do you make water holy? You punch it, you pierce it.
You put it in a pot and you boil the hell out of it.
Oh my gosh. Where'd you get this from, Google? Like badjokes.com?
Badjokes.com. Ben Klein's badjokes.com.
So another, you know, topic that I want to talk about is your family. You come from a really great family.
Both my parents live in Pittsburgh, born and raised in Pittsburgh, lived in the same house my entire life. My father runs a camera shop and some related businesses, including a museum on photographic history in Pittsburgh. My mother was a pharmacist, and now she was a stay-at-home mother, and now she helps my dad. Mm-hmm. Things like that.
What's the personality trait that you see most that you and your dad share?
My dad is a businessman, and he thinks about things in kind of cost-benefit analysis way. And I'd like to think that I've gotten some of that from him, but what I've also gotten from him is kind of my risk-taking tendencies. He's always been somebody who's told me that, you know, to get ahead in life, you have to take risks. And those risks should be calculated, but you can't leave your life shying away from them. And that's something that I think keeps pushing me forward in life.
What kind of risks do you take?
It could be anything from, you know, applying for a job that I don't think I'm qualified for or capable to get, or investing in a piece of property. I guess you could say that I've taken some personal risks, but I don't see myself as much of like a personal risk taker.
Yeah.
I mean, I follow my heart.
Yeah.
And I guess in some ways, if you think more with your heart than your head, you're taking some risks.
But you said you follow your heart. You always follow your heart?
It's a sliding scale. And, you know, on the spectrum, I think on one side you have thinker and on the other side you have feeler. And I think I lean a little bit to the feeler side, but there's definitely been times where I feel like I'm making very calculated thinker decisions.
Yeah.
But I think I have a high degree of empathy, which actually ties back to the question you asked earlier about the best traits of my parents. And I think my mother has a great sense of empathy. Mm-hmm. And I also think she's good at talking to strangers.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And that surprised me actually, because I don't see her in those environments a lot, but she is so good at carrying on a conversation with anybody. Yeah. And it could be, you know, when she was the head of the PTA and meeting people at my elementary school, it could be in the supermarket, it could be with my teachers when she would go to, you know, parent-teacher conferences. She's very good at talking to people and making them feel extremely comfortable.
Mm. Wow, so she was the PTA of the school in which you were the valedictorian, right?
No.
Oh, middle school.
Yeah. I think a co-valedictorian of Frick International Studies Academy, which was my middle school back in Pittsburgh.
And what was your best subject?
I'll tell you my worst subject. My worst, I got one B when I was in middle school.
No, you did not.
And it was in health. And it was because I missed too many classes. And the reason I missed too many classes was because I was like I would leave school early for athletic activities. Like the irony in that just confounds me.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Okay. And then your brother, John, what personality trait do you most admire that you don't have yourself?
On the thinker feeler spectrum, I think John is a really strong thinker. And a lot of his decision-making is very quantitative. And I appreciate that because he has like a toolbox that he's built up with time through his experience and work and academics that allows him to really think of things in a much more quantitative way. And I respect that because there are decisions that we've had to make mutually with respect to finances or investments where John's ability to just very quickly analyze a situation and make a quick cost-benefit analysis decision has really helped us.
Mm. What kind of trouble did you guys get into as kids?
You know, I mean, boys will be boys. There was tons of roughhousing we had. So in addition to my brother and I, there was, and I only have one brother, we had a bunch of cousins. We still do. And there was all sorts of like roughhousing and playing around. Probably the time where we created or inflicted the most damage was this afternoon we were playing in our backyard in Pittsburgh, in like the Oakland Shady Side part of Pittsburgh. And I initiated a rock fight. And what that entailed was essentially one person standing on one side of the yard and the other person standing on the other side of the yard. And we were lodging these, you know, little rocks at each other. And, you know, we thought it was funny until I missed dodging one and it hit me in the forehead. And all of a sudden I was like squirting out blood onto the porch and I freaked out. You know, I was a young kid. I freaked out. And my parents took me to the hospital. I got a couple stitches and my parents were not happy about that. And at first they blamed my brother, but then ultimately they blamed me because I was the older sibling and I started a rock fight. So.
Did you ever get into any other trouble? Were you ever sent to the principal's office?
Yeah. So I was just home over Thanksgiving and I have like a little safe in my room. One thing I found and I kept, and I like want to frame this, is a note that I got. It was like a suspension notice. And I received this notice because despite being the valedictorian, co-valedictorian of my middle school class, I was also a troublemaker. And I started a food fight. And somebody figured out it was me. It was actually, I got written up by, I guess, my equivalent of like a liberal arts teacher. And it's something along the lines of, Ben Klein started a food fight. He threw food at other students and caused a mess, something like that. But there was actually, I took great pleasure in reading this, not only because I had saved this thing. This was actually, I imagine that this notice I was supposed to give to like the administration at the school or give it to my mother. I just kept it. I just hid it. And in addition to having this thing, which is, you know, decades old now, it's like a decade and a half old, it has a misspelling in it. And I was like, so, I felt like so righteous.
That is a very good memory from childhood. And You've also said that if you have a kid and they get in trouble, you kind of want your kid to be a little bit of a troublemaker.
I am a firm believer in harmless mischief. I will look for ways to create mischief without creating harm. And I like it because it's fun and it kind of challenges the way people kind of expect their day to go. And, you know, most of what I'm referring to are just pranks where you surprise somebody or you confuse somebody or just do something that's funny. I like that. And I want my kids to have a little bit of mischief.
And what's the prank? You pulled one on one of your colleagues at work, right? For April Fool's.
Yeah. So there's one colleague who used to sit next to me, doesn't anymore, named Lewis. I rearranged his entire office as if it were somebody else's office. And it was pretty elaborate, actually, because not only did we, you know, like change the nameplate on the door and stuff like that, but we actually put up like fake pictures of this. The person's name was Frank Dinda. And the story behind Frank Dinda is I was in Lewis's office one day. He has this nameplate. It's like one of those things that sits on your desk and has like a little piece of plastic that you can pull out. And I was just tinkering with it and I realized it could slide out easily. I slid it out and I look at it and Lewis's name was like kind of on a clear sticker on this thing, but it had another side. And I looked at the other side and the other side was actually engraved. It was like that fake wood with white lettering and it says Frank J. Dinda. And I was like, Lewis, what is this? Like, why are you using the back of somebody's nameplate? And we start laughing hysterically about it. And then we have this ongoing joke about, you know, Frank Dinda and and so forth. So I converted his office into Frank Dinda's office. I had somebody call pretending to be Frank Dinda, asking why Lewis was in his office. This was all on April Fool's Day. We had fake mail delivered by interoffice mail to Frank Dinda. We had emails come in to his email inbox. We put up fake diplomas on the wall, certificates from, you know, recognition from clients that said, you know, Frank J. Dinda on it. I mean, it was just like, we had four or five people engaging in this prank, and it was just every 20 minutes, there was like a new chapter of the prank unfolding, and it was just hilarious.
Mm. You know, I think this actually ties a lot to, you're very thoughtful. Even the prank that you pulled is extremely thoughtful, and that's one of your best qualities, Ben. You always think so much about what you can do for the people who you really care about. I think my most favorite recent story about this is the cake that you made for our mutual friend Pooja for her birthday when she came to DC.
It's true. I made Pooja a cake, but it actually was like a watermelon in sheep's clothing. Natalie organized this happy hour that Pooja came to, and I showed up a little bit late because I was like, I'm going to bring Pooja a cake. But the cake that I made her was a very untraditional cake. Pooja loves watermelon more than anybody else I have ever met. And so I decided after like doing some Google research that I was going to create a watermelon cake. And by that, I mean, I was going to take a watermelon and then essentially coat it in icing. And it was a little bit more fancy than that. I was actually going to slice it in half and put a layer of icing in between. But it was going to like, essentially, it was going to be like, it looks like a birthday cake, but then you cut it open and it is bright red and you realize it's a watermelon, and she gets the added satisfaction of like knowing that she gets to blow out a candle of what looks like a birthday cake, but there's also her favorite food in it. So I buy this watermelon. I buy the biggest one I can because you want like, I'm cutting it out of like the center of the watermelon so you can get the biggest kind of circle. And I buy icing, and the day before this, I try to ice the watermelon. And it is one of the hardest things I've ever tried to do. It was cream cheese frosting, and I start trying to lather the watermelon with this stuff, and it just runs off. It's like oil and water. It just doesn't mix, and I'm like, what am I going to do? I really want to do this, and I get, as Natalie knows, I can get fixated on something. Like, I set my mind to something, and I will do everything I can to make it happen. And that's what happened with this. So I start trying to ice it, and I like over ice it. Like I put gobs of icing on and it doesn't work. And then I take it all off, and then I pat down the watermelon with paper towels. I try to dry it out, and then I do it again. It doesn't work. I give up. I put the watermelon away. I wake up extra early the morning of her birthday, which is still a work day. It's Friday. And I try to ice it again. Doesn't work. I go downstairs. I live near Trader Joe's. I go and buy some of their icing. I try it. It doesn't work. And then I'm frustrated and I just go to work. And so I know like right after work, we have this happy hour, and I'm like, I'm not going to give up on for Pooja. I'm not going to give up yet. So I go back home and I get the watermelon and I try to ice it one more time. It doesn't work. I'm like, okay, I know what I'm going to do. So I go to buy whipped cream. I buy two cans of whipped cream. And meanwhile, I'm already late for this happy hour, and Pooja can only be there for like an hour and a half because she has a pre-wedding event to attend. So I go and I buy two cans of whipped cream, and I drive over to this bar, and it was hard to find a parking spot. I park like a block and a half away, and I'm like, I'm just going to whipped cream this cake. Like, I'm going to like put whipped cream all over this cake as if it were icing, and hopefully it will just stick. And so I start doing it. I'm in my car. I'm spraying whipped cream around this cake, and it's kind of like building up. And it actually starts to look pretty good. I'm like, I'm just feeling really good about this. I know it's not going to last a long time because whipped cream is going to melt. So I take it and I lather it up and I create it. And then I have these jimmies. So jimmies are the equivalent of like sprinkles. So I put jimmies on this thing to make it look a little bit more fun. And then a cherry on top. And then I meant to add, what I did do in advance, and I actually did well, is I made these Jell-O shots with the core of the watermelon. So I carved out one of the edges of the watermelon, and I put in watermelon Jell-O into it. So it was like, and then ultimately I cut them into wedges. So it was like green wedge with a little bit of white and then bright red Jell-O. And I cut them like little points and I put them all around the cake. So it was like extra festive. So I do this and then I race to this bar with this cake in my hands. And in short, it lasted long enough for Pooja to appreciate it. And she did.
Yeah. Oh my God. That story is so funny. And it's so representative of the length that you will go to like make something happen.
I appreciate that. I have to say my car was a disaster. Like there was whipped cream and Jimmy's all over the place. It smelled bad. It was just, it was like, I really did some damage to my car that day, but it was worth it for Pooja.
Yeah. Okay. So going back to the whole like family thing. So your brother, John, he lives in Chicago with his fiance, Julie, and they have a bunny.
They do. So both of them live in Chicago in an area called Logan Square, and they have an adorable black bunny called Noodle.
And your dad has taken a fondness to Noodle.
My dad has fallen in love with this rabbit, and it kind of blows my mind. I'll give you an example. My dad, last year for Easter, decided he was going to send Noodle a care package. And he sent all sorts of like goodies and rabbit snacks. He went to like, we don't own any pets, and he went to a pet store to like buy food for Noodle. But even better than that was the fact that he picked out an Easter card with a rabbit on it and wrote a card to this rabbit. I mean, my dad is not a man of a lot of words. You know, he'll write me emails and, you know, cards for my birthday and stuff, but he wrote a long note to this rabbit. And it was really funny. It was like something along the lines of this. It was, you know, "Dear Noodle, happy Easter. I know this is like a busy and exciting time of the year for you. Rabbits get all this attention, and I want to let you know that we're thinking about you. And we've packed up some of the best rabbit treats we could find." And it had like another joke in it. And I saw this thing and I was like, wait, my dad sent you this? I could not believe it. But yeah, my dad loves Noodle. Every time he goes to Chicago, he brings something for this rabbit.
You know, I could totally see you doing something very similar. Goes back to the whole like thoughtfulness theme.
I think what you were saying before about like the thoughtfulness that comes with like a prank is true, because a really good prank is something that's really thought out. And if you're going to do that and kind of target somebody or do it for somebody, it is actually a sign that you care about that person. And it's not really a prank, because my dad is actually kind of serious about this, but it falls like somewhere on that spectrum of like doing things for other people. And, you know, sometimes it's just very benign, and sometimes there's like a little mischief involved in it. And there's like kind of that same intent, which is like the care and the concern and the interest in doing something for other people.
All right. So here are the set questions that I ask all my guests. So Ben, can you share a pet peeve of yours?
When somebody clips their nails in my presence, especially when it's in like a contained environment, like my apartment or a house, because when somebody does this, I mean, when anybody does this, you know, you want to clip all your nails, and usually it takes a minute or a couple minutes, and I start fixating on the sound of the next clipping. So it's like somebody clips, and I could be watching TV, I could be reading, I could be doing whatever, but all of a sudden, all I'm thinking about is when the next clip is going to take place. And it just irritates me, because it's all I can focus on.
Okay, so Ben, what's your favorite chore?
If it's considered a chore, it's cooking. I love to cook. After a long day of work, it's a catharsis for me. I like to engage senses that I don't get to normally engage: touch, smell, taste. It's a creative outlet. And I also love food shopping too. It's like, for me, like retail therapy is like going to the grocery store, which is, you know, low cost retail therapy. So I like buying food and I like cooking it. I don't like cleaning up, but of course I do it. And if I had to answer the least favorite chore, it would be folding clothes. I am terrible at folding clothes. And actually, I have one question that I want to pose for your listeners.
Okay. Can I answer it?
You can try your best to answer.
Ooh, okay.
So I hate folding clothes. And what I often do is, especially with like t-shirts, is I roll them up. But one thing I've never been able to fold, and you have to fold, I think. I guess I could roll it. But one thing that I really can't fold is a fitted sheet. How do you fold a fitted sheet?
Oh, yeah, I know what you mean. You just kind of like take the middles, right? Lift up the middle and then kind of like...
I can't do it.
Oh my gosh. Okay, and what is the first website you check in the morning?
When I get to work, the first website I'll probably check is New York Times.
All right, and then in honor of my favorite op-ed article, what is your best resume virtue and what is your best eulogy virtue?
My best resume virtue is probably my clerkship in Hawaii. In our profession, a federal clerkship goes a long way in terms of giving you, I think, credibility, especially as a litigator. I'll tell you what my best resume virtue is.
Huh.
I've rethought this.
Yeah.
And I really need to add it to my resume because it's not on there right now.
Yeah.
Middle school co-valedictorian.
I think that is probably your resume virtue. You should put that on there. I think that'd be such a like great talking point in an interview. You'd be like, who is this kid?
Yeah, if I don't want the job, right?
Yeah.
My eulogy virtue, I think I would have to say my loyalty to and the sacrifices I have made and will make to the people I care most about. For the people I care about, I will go to great lengths to try to make them happy and to try to be good to them. And I don't think of sacrifices purely in the sense of foregoing a job or, I don't know, moving to a certain city for the purposes of like a friend, but being loyal to that friend, doing whatever I can to help that person when they need help the most.
Mm. All right. And then final question, who is someone famous you would want to listen to this podcast episode?
Brandon Stanton. Most people know him as Honey, Humans of New York. And I think he's kind of changed the way people think about photographs. And he's had this ripple effect around the world that has resonated with people in a way I don't think Brandon or most of his audience ever expected. An example of that is recently he's been doing a series on Syrian asylum seekers. And this past week, there was a photo montage. It was like a set of four about the scientist who had built his life in Syria and essentially had it literally and figuratively come crashing down as a result of missiles hitting his house. And he had to uproot his family and leave. And he was just talking about his hopes and aspirations he's an older man. His hopes and aspirations of making a life for himself in the States and hoping that the people of Troy, Michigan, where he's ultimately going to be moving, would accept him. And Brandon's photography of this person caught the attention of people like Barack Obama. It caught the attention of Hollywood stars. It's created crowdfunding missions just to help these people who are total strangers. It's helping push people in the direction of this golden rule, which is like, here are people we don't know, but there are people who we sympathize for and we want to help change their lives. And it's like the power of photography in like the best form.
All right. So thanks for joining this episode of Personality with guest Ben Klein. Hope you all have a fantastic week and join us for next week's episode. And as always, let's talk awesome.